Welcome to The Report Card with Nat Malkus, the education policy podcast from the American Enterprise Institute. In education, certain ideas are considered out of bounds. For example, paying students, paying parents, paying teachers bonuses for good performance at the beginning of the year, and then making teachers pay back those bonuses if students don't improve sufficiently over the course of the year, using machine learning to increase diversity in college admissions, creating Ivy League feeder schools for disadvantaged students. But why are these ideas considered out of bounds? And might we want to redraw our boundaries to include them? And more broadly, why in education policy are we willing to stick with what is conventional, even when what is conventional doesn't get us the results we want? To discuss these questions and more, I invited Roland Fryer onto the podcast. Roland Fryer is a professor of economics at Harvard University. He was a MacArthur Fellow and is a winner of the John Bates Clark Medal. Roland Fryer, welcome to the Report Card.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So on this podcast, we talk a lot about learning loss. And about a year ago, you had a piece in the Wall Street Journal titled How to Make Up the COVID Learning Loss. You wrote, as it turns out, there's a way to improve student learning that even sullen teenagers won't complain about. Give them financial incentives to study hard. Roland, in brief, make the pitch. When it comes to learning loss, why should we pay students? And why might this approach work when others won't?
Put it simply, because people respond to incentives. And the calculation we're asking kids to make, which is go down this educational path and wait 12 years for your reward, is silly, right? I've been teaching Harvard for 20 years. And there's not too many people that have ever taken my class for the love of learning. They take it to give themselves a skill set so they can earn more later. And that's what these kids are doing. But we have to pay them because, they need to understand that hard work pays off now.
Now, you didn't come up with this idea just last year when you wrote the piece. You've been doing some work on this idea for a while. You've tested paying students in Chicago, Dallas, New York, Houston, D.C., Tell us a little bit about how that work got started, how you shape these programs, and what you've learned evaluating them.
Yeah, quickly, I'll give you some history. So I had, every kid, I grew up in the South. Southern kids had incentive programs when we were in school, which was if you bring home a C, someone, takes out a belt and spanks you. So that wasn't allowed to do as an experiment. That was my grandmother's experiment. So I thought we should pay kids that were positive. And it was really a very, very simple idea. And it came from, I showed up in Cambridge 20 years ago. I'd never been to a dinner party. I go to a dinner party and there's some 10-year-old sitting around giving a lecture about volcanoes while we have, the appetizers. And I just realized at that moment, this kid sees that education pays off. In the neighborhood I grew up in, it wasn't so obvious, right? And so I thought, what if we made it obvious that education pays off now, right? Because if I ask my daughters, would you rather have an ice cream cone today or three tomorrow? They're like, yeah, one today sounds right. The discount rate for kids is enormous. And so I thought, why not pay them now? And we went around, this is a long, 20 years ago now. We went around and started looking at all the failures that were happening, a lot of things that you talk about on the show, in places like Chicago, Washington, D.C., Dallas, all the major cities. And in particular, in their most troubled schools, people had tried a lot of things and a lot of things didn't work. And I said, but no one's tried the most obvious thing, which is just pay them to do well. And it was like the third rail. My gosh, people were so upset. Oh my gosh, Roland's going to ruin Beowulf for the pure value of Beowulf. But what we did over time was we ended up giving out, well, kids ended up earning, not giving out, roughly $10 million across five cities, where we paid kids to do well in school. And that differed by city. So in Dallas, we paid fourth graders $2 a book to read. In New York, we paid kids to get higher test scores. In Chicago, we paid for grades. In DC, we paid kids for a series of what we'd call KPIs in the business world, which are things like coming to class on time, doing their homework, not beating anybody up, et cetera. And so what we've seen is that this is a phenomenal way to get kids to do what they're incentivized to do. The trouble is they don't do a lot of the things that they're still incentivized not to do. And so I'll leave it at that. And if any of that piques your interest, you can keep digging.
Well, look, you know, some of this makes a ton of sense, right? There's a long-term payoff, but it's years away for students. I don't see the trail of breadcrumbs between here and there. Leave me some breadcrumbs, though, and I might actually get there. Of course, however, I imagine the way you structure these incentives matters. For example, I can imagine that, hey, we'll give you $25 for an A at the end of the quarter may not work in the same way that we'll give you two if you do these incremental steps along the way. What have you found here, and does it differ across grades?
Really, really important point. So a very simple thing emerged in the data, which was when we pay kids to do things that they are that will make them better off later, simple tasks, reading a book, coming to class with your homework done, those things were miraculously successful. When we actually paid kids to get an outcome, get better grades, get higher test scores, all of those failed because we believe kids, you can pay them for the outcome and they get excited, but then they actually don't know the steps it takes to get to that outcome, right? And so that's what we found. And yes, you're right. If you pay kids for reading books, they read a whole lot of books. Here's one last thing, which is interesting. It's another careful and a little bit of a cautionary tale on incentives. We paid kids in Houston to do math homework. And oh my gosh, Nat, they did a standard deviation more homework. They did a ton more math homework, but they did less English homework. And so what we were hoping for was that the total amount of time devoted to school would increase. And that's not what happened. What happened is they did more math, a little less English. And you know what? Their math scores went up and their English scores went down. And so it just shows me incentives very powerful, even for the youngest kids.
Yeah, but complicated. And they are good economists. They know how to allocate their resources. They know their resource frontiers as well. So let me ask you about this. The ideal way to set this up would be, hey, we need to target not just these specific steps, do these problems, and you'll get better results on this math test, but rather the habits of mind of what it means to be a good student. So students put in the work. But that's much harder to do. It's much harder to get those incentives to align so that you build those habits, those enduring habits. So how do you think about just the technical possibility of designing a paid incentive structure that would help students to build those habits and would generalize to history and social studies and so on, and that would help make students into lifelong learners, just to use a cliche at the end here?
Yeah. Well, the last part is hard. Let's start with the first part, which is how do you design a system that doesn't have this kind of multitasking problem that you just described. It is complicated, but it's doable. And that means the incentive, and the way to do it is the incentives need to be across several different types of variables. And where you need to really focus is to ensure that the incentives are to increase the total amount of effort, not to substitute between. So I wouldn't give incentives, again, for someone to do, you know, math homework in a homeroom where there's math and English, because then they're going to crowd out English. But I'm happy to give them incentives to read more books at home because I'm not crowding out a lot of schoolwork that happens at home. Okay, that's number one. Now, the number two thing you ask is how do I then make them lifelong people who love learning? I don't know. Let's start with my Harvard undergrad. I don't know how to do it for them. So let's not talk about K through 12 as being just the problem there. Even some of the most elite students in the country, again, are doing it because the incentives are clear, not because they love Beowulf. And so I think it's okay to have a system that focuses on the incentives of being educated, whether it's not just income, but health, being a good citizen. There's all sorts of incentives to being well-educated. So I don't have a problem with that. And so I think we've got to keep ensuring that folks understand there are real incentives. They don't have to be financial now, but real long-term incentives of having a more educated populace.
I know you've run into some headwinds when you say we should pay students to do well in school. I know you've had some people say, well, it's bad for helping students to develop a love of learning. What other kind of pushback do you tend to get?
Why are you spending more money on schools that are failing? The third one is if you take the incentives away, they're going to do worse, right? And turns out when you take the incentives away, they start to go back to their other behavior. Turns out if you don't go to the gym, you stop getting the benefits too. That's the whole point, is it was working while you were doing it. You're right. The pushback 20 years ago was like a tsunami. I mean, people were really, really upset. I used to get up every morning at 4 o'clock in the morning to see if a given experiment had been canceled in the middle of the night because of all the pushback. It really was crazy. I would say now, though, it's much more mainstream. There are folks around the country who are doing incentive programs in various ways. Not all of them are giving out cold, hard cash, but, you know, Pizza Hut's been giving out pizzas for good grades for a very long time. So it is growing in popularity across the country, and people are starting to be less averse to it.
At the top of this conversation, I brought up paying students in the context of COVID learning loss, right? And when it comes to COVID learning loss, we have not seen any silver bullets. We haven't even seen many brass bullets. So let me put out a thought experiment, in part because you have some experience setting up these kinds of programs. So I'm thinking about this year's seniors. They're in eighth grade, right? When the pandemic hit, they were in ninth grade, a pretty crucial time in their academic progression. And I'm assuming a large proportion of them took a real hit and have not caught up or made a lot of progress catching up in some fundamental areas. We have a year left for these kids before they go off to college or to the workforce. If you're a superintendent or building leader listening to this, who's thinking, man, I have no ammunition left. Could something like this work? And part of the reason I'm asking this is because there's all this federal funding that's around for about one more year. So how hard would it be to set something like this up?
For sure. And the incentives are immediate. Okay. So again, years ago, people didn't even think that kids would really respond to the incentives. They just thought they liked the attention, but they wouldn't respond to the incentives. So when we paid kids $2 an objective mastered in math, one of the things we did in that was we, you know, a given Monday morning, we just did a lightning round for schools and we say, you know what, this week it's $4. You saw the amount of effort go up. We waited another month. This month, this week, it's $6. And it went up, you know, almost triple from that point forward, right? So, yes, kids respond to incentives. And if you can, again, subject to all the caveats we've talked about before, but if you can get an incentive structure, it's relatively easy to implement. And the key thing is, do you have high-quality things for them to do, right? So they're going to get very excited. They're going to do exactly what you ask them to do. Maybe not anymore, right? When I've got a personal trainer, I got the card. As soon as I'm done, I don't go keep doing the exercises. I go home, right? So they're going to do exactly what you tell them to do. So you need to ensure that what you tell them to do is really rich and that it's high quality. And that can come in myriad different ways. That can be using technology to do it. It can be using tutors, teachers at school. You know, schools should figure that out. But I can tell you that this will get students' attention. And one last thing, and I'll promise I'll get off this soapbox, is particularly kids who are the most vulnerable. Okay, so one of the things that really stuck with me was that a 12-year-old in D.C. told me, you know what I really like about this? And I said, let me guess, the money. And she says, well, the money's not bad. But what I really like is that I may be only 12, but I'm basically treated like an adult in every other part of my life. I got to take care of my little sister. I have to do this. I have to do that. Only at school am I treated like a child. And this makes me feel like I'm really responsible for something, like at home. And that's always touched me, that essentially this made her want to step up at school and do really well. And our program in D.C. really increased test scores a lot.
So stepping back a little bit, this idea is kind of out of bounds, right? Like at the school board meeting, this doesn't make the agenda most of the time. And in education more generally, we're often willing to consider this curricular intervention or that new way to contact parents, but we are often unwilling to consider things that are more fundamental or groundbreaking. So I'm curious as to whether you think there are other things in the ed reform world or in education policy that are out of bounds, but maybe shouldn't be.
Yeah, that's a great question. And you're right. A lot of people view this as out of bounds, as I said before. But I would say that we are given incentives. Kids are given incentives to do all manner of things. So it's not, if you don't give them financial incentives, there's still other incentives. I got two daughters, right? It's ice cream. It's this. It's allowance at the end of the week, all tied to performance in some way or the other. Okay. What else are we doing that's not there? I would say that, frankly, maybe this is controversial too. Most of the hard work we're not doing, right? So what we're doing is exactly what you described. We're looking for silver bullets in curriculum or an after-school program. We're looking for things that we can all agree are good things to change. And we're hoping, crossing our fingers, that this is going to amount to fundamental change. And I just don't see it. And so I think part of it is, you know, an incentive misalignment, right? Like teachers, parents, school administrators, students, all should be working towards common goals. We're not spending enough time focused on doing things like, you know, small group tutoring. That is a way that's been proven over and over again that you can, you know, substantially increase performance of students. And, you know, we tutor a little bit here, a little bit there, et cetera. We're focused on the things that don't matter as much, like class size and whether or not someone's got the right certification. But we're not focused on the things that we know really, really do matter, like small group instruction vis-a-vis tutoring, or how to use data to provide feedback, real feedback for your teachers, and not just here's some kids who are in trouble, but given the latest assessment, what should we reroute and actually change in our behavior that will drive performance? And that those are hard conversations to have. And so I think there's unfortunately, for a very long time, we've been unwilling to have these hard conversations about things that are difficult to change. And we focused on, you know, low-hanging fruit, but that fruit is not nearly as sweet.
You know, in a number of different articles, you say, hey, let's bring some data to bear on these things, including on affirmative action, which we'll get to in a bit. But look, there was a push about 10 years ago under the Obama administration to bring student test data to bear on teacher evaluation. And that, of course, lit a lot of fuses and made a lot of people mad. It had some good results in some areas, but if you misalign incentives, things can go sideways and so on and so forth. But look, this was kind of one of those first attempts, it seems to me, to plug data back in to get a feedback loop that was really working aside from just like, you know, report cards and test scores. What do you think that did to the potential that we're looking at now, where we have lots more feedback loops? And how difficult is it to bring data to bear on what we do in schools?
Yeah, it's difficult, but it's essential. So I would say 15 years ago, exactly as you described, data was considered to be an asset. Now it's a liability, right? The teachers are inundated with data from this and data from that and data from this, and they don't know how to process it. It doesn't manifest itself into clear action steps that they should take for tomorrow. And so over the years, I've worked with schools on exactly that. If you get a report from a, you know, test company, sometimes I've seen these reports be 300 pages and you know, teacher's report is somewhere on page 68. No one's going for that, right? And so the question is, how do we figure out what actions tomorrow should change based on the test results I got today? That is the key step. In my own research, that's where we found the fault lines in that first approach, that version one approach that you described. Yes, I'd say, hey, Nat, you know what? You have 20% of your kids on green, 40% on yellow, and 40% red. There's data. But if you don't know what to change tomorrow, that's going to be useless. And you're going to get that every 6 weeks. And you know what? Next 6 weeks is going to be 20-40-40 again. When I've tried to help manage schools in a data-driven process, what we've done is we've done small check for understandings every day that rolled up into a weekly kind of assessment, not assessment, but kind of report out. And then, yes, every few weeks you would see where the students were. And then if, let's say, 50 of the students, 50% got one concept and 50 didn't, then you'd reteach that. And so there's this constant tension and play between mastery and pace, and you use data to drive that process. If it's a situation where 80% get it and 20% don't, 80%, the whole class goes ahead, the 20% you wrap in tutoring after or before school to make sure they catch up, and you keep going. And so there's real processes, process maps, and serious strategy
around how to use data. You can't just have a data room at a school. That's just nerdy wallpaper. I mean, you stick it up on the wall. We all see that half the kids are failing, and we go home at the end of the day and go, what are we supposed to do? To really get serious about this, it takes tremendous amounts of effort and focus, not only what the data are telling us, but what are the concrete action steps that we're going to take. And you know what? When the first action step doesn't produce better results, there's got to be plan B, C, and D. And one of the things, and I'll be quite upfront, one of the things I've seen is that bad schools have no plan. Good schools have plan A. Plan B. Great schools have plan B, C, and D. And really a serious strategy of how to ensure that every kid gets to where they need to be.
So I want to get back a little bit to the incentives. We've been talking about paying students, but you've also done some work on paying teachers and paying parents. I want to talk about teachers next. There's a lot of work on performance pay, but you did some interesting work on how payments to teachers get framed. Can you talk about what you did there and what you found?
Sure. It was kind of one of the first experiments trying to test loss aversion. So the idea of loss aversion is that it hurts a lot worse to lose money than it does to just make money. Getting a bonus is very different from taking salary away. I learned this concept in my first social psychology class in undergraduate, and I thought, you know, this was one of the most powerful insights I'd ever heard. You know what I would do? I was such a nerd. So I would go to a restaurant, and I'd estimate the expected tip. Let's say if it was $20. I'd put the $20 on the end of the table. Every time the waiter or waitress did something I didn't quite like, I would take some of the money back and put it in my pocket. You get the best service you can imagine if you do that. In any event, so that's the basic concept. And so most all of the teacher incentive things we had seen before are things like, let's pay a whole group of teachers to do well, right? We did that in New York City, spent millions and millions of dollars. As zero can get trying that. Other incentive programs are you, Roland, like, hey, if you do well, we'll give you incentives. Some of those have worked, some of them not. What we did was say, oh, no, we expect you to make progress. In fact, we expect your students to have a full year of growth in your classroom. And so we're going to increase your salary by $10,000 for doing that. Now, if you don't do it, we'll take some back. And what we found was that increased test scores a lot more than paying for performance, right? And so it was one of the first real tests of loss aversion in the field. But the idea is people are more motivated by losing salary than they would be by getting it.
And, you know, you've done a lot of this work as a professor, as an evaluator, and so forth. You've also done some work in cities setting these things up. You worked in New York for a while as the chief equality officer? Is that what they gave you?
My wife still makes fun of me for that title. Yeah, chief equality officer.
Hey, you got to take what they give you. Just briefly, what strikes you as the big difference between the work as an evaluator of these things and working in the government in your experience? What's the chief advantage to being in the government and what's the chief frustration?
Yeah, the chief advantage is being able to architect it exactly as you want, right? It never made sense to me. Maybe I was naive as a 25-year-old, a 28-year-old economist. Why is everyone sitting in their offices in Cambridge waiting for someone else to produce the data? Right? Like, I get that that's a better life. Someone else does the work. You sit there, you download it, you have a coffee while it downloads, you estimate the group A do better than group B, then you go home, right? That's a good life. Now, on the other hand, what if the data to download isn't perfect, isn't what exactly you would do, right? You can't sit around and hope there's going to be data out there on paying kids to learn. Well, you can't sit around out there and hope that someone's going to take over 20 of the worst performing schools in Houston and do exactly your idea so that you can get the results. And so I liked the ability to not just be a social scientist, but to be a social engineer, to get in there, roll your sleeves up, talk to families, learn something. Maybe you actually change. It's different than working out on the whiteboard with your colleagues over a cup of coffee. It's very different to get in and talk to parents and understand their pain points and what they're struggling with, what they find important, and practitioners on the ground. So I love that messy process of kind of co-creating what the treatment should be. Okay. Economists fancy themselves on being real scientists. Well, okay, well, if you sit at a chalkboard, you can kind of develop the next vaccine. Sure. you know, schools are a lot different than that, much more complicated, much more interesting. And so I like developing the vaccines with people in the field. Okay, so that's the positive. What's the negative? It's the government, man. It takes, you know, I've been kicked out of New York City schools 3 times. Just in the middle of an experiment, someone doesn't like it. Someone, the right person or the wrong person, writes the letter to the school's chancellor and they stop the program. Right? Mid-stride, you've already raised the money. And so it's risky. That's why a lot of scholars don't do it. Can you imagine working 13, 15 months at something, they just cut it off, can't do it? Don't have that problem. You're just downloading data from your office.
That's right. That's right.
That's the issue. That's the real issue. On some dimensions, you gain control, but on a whole set of other dimensions, you lose control.
So speaking of something that you can get in trouble if they let you back in New York again, you've also done some work on parent incentives, paying parents for outcomes, which...
I'm paying you for this interview. I will pay you. I'm not. I'm just going to be...
No transactions were received here. So tell us about your work on parents. What's the motivating factor for paying parents? Which parents were you paying and for what outcomes?
Great. A couple of reasons. Number one, I don't know how many times I've heard in the last 20 years, we just got to get the parents more involved. We just got to get the parents more involved. All right. Well, let's get them involved. That's number one. Number two, and here's where it really came from. I was walking around an early childhood center in Tulsa, Oklahoma. But I love being in the field. I love touring. I love doing social engineering. And they are bragging about how awesome this thing is. Okay. And so it's $30,000 per kid for like a 2-year-old. That's the cost of this center because they've got the right Playmobil, like whatever it is they got it right. And so I asked the executive in charge of the center, on average in this community, how many kids does a family take? Bring here. Two. I said, my God, that is a $60,000 transfer to a family. You could just stop poverty at that point, right? And I said, look, this seems great. I just don't know if there's $60,000 value here. And so why not give that to the parents to do the types of things you're doing here? That could be their job, is to actually develop a curious kid who wants to do the types of things that you're doing here. So that's what we did. We started with early childhood centers, and we ran an experiment between putting kids in standard early childhood care, where you know, standard $15,000, $12,000 a year per kid, and another experiment where we said, hey, what if parents could earn that money if their kids hit certain benchmarks along the way? And let's tie it all the way back to the beginning. If you want parents involved, let's not start in algebra. let's start with color identification and shapes and the things that nearly every parent can be helpful with. So that's what we did. It was early childhood. And, you know, that faced real criticism, too. You know, I pitched that idea after it was done and we saw the results, which were, by the way, the kids who were at home with their parents not only had the same academic skills as the kids in early childhood centers, but they had a lot better non-cognitive skills. Executive function, all the things that people say we need and are just almost as important as the non-cognitive skills. So really interesting set of results. And where it got caught up politically was that people said, well, we don't want to pay parents to do the things they're supposed to do anyway. That's a hard stance to take because it's a circular argument. We're in this issue because they're not doing them, but we don't want to pay them to do them.
Yes. And as you said, we will pay $60,000 a family for an educational institution to try and make up for it. But that's, well, I was going to say it's beside the point. Seems sort of directly on point, but nonetheless. All right, Roland, we have a section on this podcast called Grade It. I'm going to throw something out. You give me a grade and why. You ready?
I'm ready.
Teacher specialization.
Right. Can be important, but when we did an experiment on it, when teachers specialized, they didn't spend enough time with students. So particularly younger students, they didn't get to know them as well, and their test scores declined. So I would say important for older students because the material is so difficult, really potentially harmful for younger students.
Growth mindset.
Incomplete. I don't know enough, but I don't think the evidence is good. I think people really like it. But I don't think the evidence is strong enough to warrant really making this a broad-based strategy.
New York City's specialized high schools.
A, for kids who are doing really well. B, for kids at the margin. Okay, so students who are really gifted, who are at the top of the kind of test score distributions to get in there, I'm sure these are great schools for them. But kids at the margin, what we show is that kids who, you know, were right at the cutoff didn't actually do as well.
Free speech at Harvard. You're a Harvard professor. Fire recently ranked at last on the list. What do you say?
I don't think I'm allowed to say that. That proves the point.
Urban boarding schools.
I'm going to go with B+. Really effective at increasing math scores, really effective at increasing ELA scores, something we don't typically see in the charter school landscape, but really expensive. So I would probably have given it an incomplete, but I like the effect on test scores. But what we really need to do is follow up and see if there are other things, teen pregnancy, crime, civic participation, that also change because you were in the boarding school.
Harlem Children's Zone.
A-. Harlem Children's Zone has done a phenomenal job, particularly with their student demographic. I'm only not giving them an A+ or an A because I want to see it expanded. So it's fine to do it in Harlem, and the leaders are phenomenal there. But I want to see that same model, not just the after school things and the outside of school characteristics. I want to see that school model along with everything, full bundle of services. I want to see that in Kansas. I want to see it in Chicago. I want to see it in California, et cetera. And I haven't seen that.
But do they get any bonus points for thinking out of the box?
Yeah, that's why I'm a tough grader. They got an A-.
You are a tough grader. I'll take it. Teach for America.
Oh, man. A- for the teachers of America. So I think people who go through the program, I know from my own research, people who go through the program have a phenomenal experience and it changes them. I would give it a B on the effects on kids because the test score effects have been small.
All right, let's turn to affirmative action. Way back in October 22, so this is well before the Supreme Court came out with its decision on affirmative action, you wrote a piece titled "Affirmative Action in College Admissions Doesn't Work, But It Could." What did you then think was wrong with affirmative action?
I thought that what we really should be doing is looking and finding students who would be high value add to admit to the college. I mean, they were diamonds in the rough, so to speak. And I thought we could use, and still think, we could use all of these advances in AI and in email to actually really collect data and, not use those advances to collect data, but to collect data and use those advances to help find them. That's what I was really interested in. And I wondered how far we could get in terms of our diversity goals at these universities, if we had more just pure meritocracy in the admissions process, where we could really find students who are going to excel in college. Because right now we have a few variables that we collect, essays, SAT scores, and things like that, but we can do stuff that's much more holistic than that. And so that's what I was arguing for, that, hey, this is an opportunity to get really serious and do the next kind of version of real selection into our institutions.
What's your theory of the case for why many universities have a hard time doing diversity on their campus well? And here I'm talking about truly finding the diamond in the rough. As you've observed, a lot of the minority students that make it to these campuses are advantaged in other ways. It's not a pure meritocracy wherein the best students rise to the top. Universities are not like, hey, we're going to find the talent. So why is diversity so hard?
I think it's because they're more passive than active. yes, of course, they have recruiters that go, I get all that, but they could, that's still relatively passive, right? And so I believe in a system that's a lot more active, where we go out and use these techniques I described earlier to really source and find students that would naturally, not naturally be on the road. Let me give you an example. I'm going to say Harvard Medical School because I think it's general, but it could be a division within Harvard Medical School, told me that during COVID, right, their typical process is to go through their process, narrow it down to a set of students who they're willing to fly up to Cambridge, fly those kids up to Cambridge, they do the interviews, and then they admit from that stack. Okay? And let's just say, this is wrong, but let's just say they need to admit 100 students. They fly up 150 or 200 and admit from that. Okay. Now COVID hits and they're not going to fly anybody up. So what they realize is maybe instead of doing just 200 for our short list, it's Zoom. We can do 500 because we don't have to fly. We don't have to incur the cost of putting people up. And you know what? Lo and behold, it was their most diverse class ever because there was something about that process of selection, right, that got the of narrowing to the 200 that ruled out people that if they had a chance to meet them, they would have actually understood that they were a lot better than they seemed on paper and would have admitted them, independent of any racial preference. It was just, this person looks good. Okay. And so what I was advocating in that October piece, which was published on the first day of oral argument, was that, hey, maybe there's even a different selection model by different groups, right? We're all constraining all this data to be the same, but it could very well be that a public school in this demographic has much more predictive power from one group relative to another. And we ought to really dive in and allow the algorithms and the science to surface people we should take a look at.
Now, there's a whole push in admissions to be test optional, right? You know, the tests are problematic, so we should just go test optional. How do you respond to folks who support test optional admissions policies, especially when you're arguing that actually we need more metrics and data to figure out who the best applicants really are?
When a thermometer tells you you're cold, your first reaction shouldn't be to throw out the thermometer. I don't believe in making application processes more shallow. I believe in making applicant pools deeper. And I think that's just the problem. I think several of the things that we've talked about for the last 51 minutes have been about laziness. It's a lot easier to just make SAT optional. Right? It's way harder to figure out which kid in Mississippi or Alabama or Georgia or Tallahassee, Florida. Like it's much more difficult to figure out which kid is a lot better than their test scores might tell you. It's really hard to figure out, not only let's look at their set of accomplishments, but let's try to estimate the set of constraints and obstacles they had to get over to get to those test scores. Now, people have done that and tried to do it in various ways over time, but this is the time to do it with all the data that's going around. And so I really believe that if given the right opportunity, everyone in every zip code is equally talented and can succeed in the same ways. I fundamentally believe that. And so for me, it's never going to be, let's make it easier. That's insulting, right? I'm a kid, I was an athlete. And when we wanted to win games, we didn't go whisper in the other kid's ear, hey, could you make touchdowns optional? Like that was never a thing that doesn't come into an athlete's way of thinking. What folks really need, and I grew up in these neighborhoods, I understand to some extent, want more opportunities. They're not asking for, to be treated differently. And so I really believe that if we stop being lazy and stop using the same techniques that we've used before, and actually got out here and sourced people in a real way, if the incentives to find them were correct, by the way, that this problem would not really be a problem.
Now, you just said, if we stay on the same track. I mean, one of the questions that bothers me about this is that there is no college admissions officer or president out there who's going to say, hey, we got it figured out. Our school has a perfect diversity quotient. We're right where we want to be. But it seems that not too many colleges are saying that they need to make large scale changes to the way they recruit students. I mean, it seems like the appetite for change is great when it comes to going test optional, but the appetite for change in terms of how we recruit and test students is relatively lacking.
Oh, man. he fell into the same hustle I did. I really believed him for the first 10 years. For the first 10 years, when I said to folks, hey, you know, what should we do about diversity in my department? There's 50 faculty members. I'm the only black faculty member here. We should probably have some more diversity. I said, pipeline. Pipeline. Well, what are we supposed to do in admissions offices? Pipeline. We got to look. It's K through 12. What did we say in K through 12? It's pre-K. What do we say in pre-K? It's the parents. We do a phenomenal job of passing the blank. Okay? And so I just don't believe it, right? I think they got exactly the diversity they want. Sorry to be a radical here, man, but I've been watching this for 20 years, and it's always something else, right? Very rarely what you hear is, you know what? I don't know what it is, but here are the five deep initiatives we're doing to change the damn pipeline. It doesn't just come from the heavens, right? And that's why when I wrote this piece recently with the court decision, I said, let's actually create feeder schools. Let's figure out a way, right? We can have 100 schools around the country. We can have 500 kids in each school. That's 50,000 kids. Let's say we have 10% of them that we think are top enough level to go to Ivy League schools. That would be a phenomenal success. So let's put real institutions that do all the hard work that we've described throughout this cast, do it in those places. You can start them in ninth grade or sixth grade, whenever you want. And let's bring kids up to Cornell standards and Columbia standards and Harvard standards. And I fundamentally believe we can do that. I don't think we need to lower the standards for them.
And you did push on that proposal. You argued that Ivy League should set up these schools and pay for them. I mean, they're sitting on $200 billion. That's a good bit of money. And you say something here that I think is pretty thought-provoking. You say that in order for this proposal to make sense, you have to believe that there's enough talent out there to draw on, and you have to believe that it can be paid for. And I think you've argued persuasively for both of these two points. There's enough talent out there and the Ivy League can pay for it. But let me ask you this. When you say, hey, let's let the Ivies set it up, do you think the Ivies are capable of setting up institutions that can do the really tough work in education? That's finding students who are not advantaged and educating them to the standard of the Ivy League? I mean, that's not easy work.
No, and I don't think they can do the work. I think they can pay for it. I think they can set up the structure for it. And they think they can hire the Jeff Canadas, the Kaya Hendersons of the world to come run it. I don't expect them to run it, but they can set it up and pay for it and get the structure done.
And if we're looking for this challenge, you are just going to expect someone to actually do something about the pipeline rather than adjust things on the margins.
No, we've been trying things on the margin and getting zero results. Okay. And so, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm getting old. I can't take another lecture or panel or politician who says, ever since the nation of risk at risk, right? And we all know that. It's gotten not a lot better. Okay. And so we're the generation who grew up listening to this. Let's do something about it. Or admit we don't want to, but let's stop bullshitting. That's all I want, right? Like, we got other stuff to do, and we're not going to take this seriously. But yes, I believe Ivy League schools can do that. I think it's an audacious plan, and you know, it would take up whatever my estimate was, half of the growth, not the endowment, the growth over the next 10 years. And my point is this. If we don't do it, then in 4 years, when we're looking at who's matriculated at Harvard and Yale, let's not blame it on the pipeline anymore. That's all. Let's say we decided not to do it.
Thanks for listening to The Report Card with Nat Malkus, and special thanks to our guest, Roland Fryer. We'll include a link to some of Roland's work in the show notes. Remember, you can subscribe to The Report Card on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you download podcasts. While you're there, take a minute to leave us a review. That helps other people find the show. You can send us your comments, questions, or topic suggestions to ed.podcast@aei.org. That's it for this episode. I'm Nat Malkus.